This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Talking in Tongues, the Hopes and Fears of Interfaith Dialogue. My name is Stephen Pickard and I'm the chair of this conversation. I'm Assistant Bishop in the Diocese of Adelaide. Interfaith dialogue is one of the great challenges of this century. There are many good reasons for this. The religious impulse of human beings is deep-seated and persistent and continually finds expression in different faith traditions in the world. A religious faith, it is increasingly clear, cannot be easily fenced off into the private world of individuals. Indeed, it is highly resistant to this. Rather, faith is the reality of the public space, an activity or a disposition which cannot be kept in the private world. It is increasingly clear as well that religious and faith values inform a great deal of our lives, socially, economically, and politically. And then there is finally the resurgence of fundamentalism in many faith traditions. And this is one of the uncontested facts of our world. All of these things mean that interfaith dialogue is unavoidable, important, and in many places urgent, particularly for the well-being of human beings and this planet. Well, enough from me. Today we have three panellists to provoke our thinking and offer differing perspectives on the hopes and fears of interfaith dialogue. I'll invite each speaker to speak to us, address us for 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll have an opportunity for questions and conversation. And there is a microphone, I believe, somewhere, down there in the middle, for the time when you have some questions to ask. Our first speaker is Gary Baumer. Gary is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Monash University, and UNESCO Chair in Intercultural and Interreligious Relations in Asia Pacific, and also an Associate Priest in the Anglican Parish of St John's East Malvern in the Anglican Diocese of Melbourne. He's Deputy Chair of the World Conference on Religion and Peace in Australia, and is Chair and Board of Directors of the Parliament of the World's Religions 209, and a Fellow of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. His research in sociology of religion is well known. Principally, he examines the management of religious diversity in plural, multicultural societies. And he's an author of many books. Most recent books include Australian Soul, Religion and Spirituality in the 21st Century, and also Democracy in Islam with Sayed Kitab. Gary, we welcome you and we look forward to your address.
Thank you, Stephen. Well, I've been involved in interreligious relations, from the time I was born. You see, my father's side of the family went to church a very great deal, and my mother's side of the family didn't go at all. And that provided a certain frisson in the family and difficulty, because my mother's side were the nice ones, and my father's side were the ones that engaged my mind. And so there's always been that trying to make the difference and to bridge the difference and to figure out how to deal with it. I can't say that I have a solution. I've also been a religious professional in 8 different denominations, not because I wander, but that's because that's where my spiritual journey took me. And I respect deeply the differences of each one, the richness that each offers. I draw still from each one, but I reside at the moment as an Anglican, reasonably happy, although itchy from time to time. That whole business of religious difference is a lived part of my existence, which has led me to be involved in it, and it's a very interesting activity. Australia is very religiously diverse. We're one of the most religiously diverse nations in the world, and that's primarily due to migration, to a certain degree to conversion. So we have more Muslims than we do Lutherans, more Buddhists than Baptists, more Hindus than Jews, and 4 times as many witches as Quakers. And that diversity is a lived experience of very many Australians. And that's a very important starting point for the examination of interfaith relations and their hopes and their fears. Now, interfaith relations have a fairly interesting history in the world. One of the first major events was the first meeting of the Parliament of the World's Religions in Chicago following the Chicago Columbian Exhibition in 1893. And it was the first time that Western Christian theologians engaged with Hindus and with Muslims and with others in dialogue toward understanding. Then we had a whole century of ecumenism where we all tried to make Christians have the same committee structure so we'd all be one, which was an interesting activity. But in 1993, some people said, hey, look, this idea of 1893 was also a good one for now. And so the second meeting of the Parliament of the World's Religions was held, and now it meets every 5 years. In the 80s and 90s, a number of major global organizations were formed to promote worldwide interreligious relations, usually working with heads of faith, heads of government, and working at that very top level of religious and political organizations. And that's important. It's really nice if our leaders will talk to each other, share a stage with each other, at least be civil to each other. That's rather better than not being so. But what's happening now, to me, is really fascinating. In the last 15 years, the energy of interfaith has gone to the grassroots. And so ordinary Australians around the country are setting up little interfaith meetings in neighborhoods or cities or on disciplinary interests or other kinds of interests, getting people together to bridge these differences with face-to-face interaction. And it's really exciting to me to see that happen. What are their hopes? What are their dreams? Very simply, to reduce negative othering, to bring in an understanding of another person's faith, to see how that faith works, that is, how a person draws on their faith tradition in order to find energy to do this, to sacrifice for that, or to be interested in this cause, to share discussions around sacred text, to learn, so that the other becomes a real person, really grounded in their own faith, that you understand. And you can see how that human works. And it doesn't make you want to become them or them become you, but it does take that negative othering away. They're no longer a stranger. They're no longer distant. They're no longer feared. And that's the goal. That's the aim. The fears, I suppose, have to do with being run over by those groups that seem to insist on negative relationships with others, like claiming they have the only truth, trying to make Australia a Christian country, or something like that. And we've seen ugly examples of it, like Sri Lanka being made a Buddhist country. Very unpleasant. So all nations manage their religious diversity differently. I think Australia's been doing a phenomenally good job, and many Australians have taken responsibility for engaging themselves in close intercontact with people of other faith in their own locales, which is, I think, a very healthy way to go to reduce negative othering, to break down the barriers, and to be left with respect for the other and a respect for the difference. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary. Our second speaker is Shakira Hussain. Shakira is a writer and researcher focusing on the issues of Islam, gender, and South Asia, as well as Muslim countries and communities in Australia. Her writing has appeared regularly in publications such as New Matilda and The Australian, and it draws on encounters in Australia, Britain, Indonesia, India, and Pakistan. She completed her PhD at the Australian National University, where she is currently a visiting fellow. She belongs to a multi-ethnic, multi-faith family and became a researcher in order to make sense of it. We look forward very much to hearing you, Shakira.
Okay, well, like Gary, I have been participating in interfaith dialogue from a very young age, really by necessity and with close members of my own family. And hi, Mum. And so name a member of a world religion you can think of and several that you can't, probably haven't heard of, and it's quite likely that I've got a reasonably close relative who belongs to it. And as a child, I really couldn't see the point of religious conflict, because as my mother, who's a veteran of interfaith relations, always maintained, really political differences matter a lot more than religious differences. And I always thought so too. Never mind what do you do if you belong to different religions, you know, at Christmas and Ramadan or whatever. What the hell do you do on election night if you're sitting in the living room with someone who voted for a different party? Like, my mother always said, being married to someone of a different religion, not a problem at all, but absolutely never someone from the National Party. You know, that's, some things are just way out of bounds. And I thought, always thought, yes, transgressive and really a little bit kinky. So, but I will swing back to that, because I think that a lot of the issues that are being now arising in the context of interfaith dialogue are still political issues rather than religious issues, and that point about political differences being way more hard to overcome than religious differences, yes, that I still maintain that. So, yes, I have gone to a lot of interfaith events over the last number of years, and as Gary said, there have been a lot of them. And I also feel that they're a positive initiative. I mean, apart from anything else, the food's normally good. And I worked as a housekeeper in a Jewish Iranian family for 2 years, and I really missed, when I left, the Friday night meals. And not so much the Friday night washing up, but, you know. And it gives me great pleasure still to go to celebrate Jewish high holidays among Jewish people and be participating in that sense. And it's a pleasure to me to invite people from other religious backgrounds to come to Muslim community events during Ramadan, and Christians as well, and their holidays too. And I think that that has had a positive effect of allowing people to become familiar with their neighbours and to understand where they're coming from. But I have some friends who've been very active in trying to overcome these dynamics of negative othering and hostility in the post 9/11 years, and particularly as regards Muslims who don't themselves have a religious identity. And the venue for a lot of this, you know, getting to know each other, getting along better, promoting harmony, has been interfaith dialogue events. And although people who don't have a religious identity are very welcome at those events, they sometimes felt a bit left out. And they've written about this, some of them. I can give you the references afterwards if you want, about feeling as though they're on the outside a bit, as though they want to participate more fully, but they don't have a prayer to get up and say. They don't have a God in their own hearts that they want to thank for the meal. They don't have a ritual where they can invite people from the, you know, the Muslim, the Jewish, the Catholic, whatever community to come and share it. And so they're feeling a bit locked out of this process. And some of the most hostile interfaces, except that if you can call them that, because there's not a much interface happening, are between people of religious identity and militant atheists. And that's where I think a lot of the talking needs to happen. But you're not going to catch Richard Dawkins at an interfaith dialogue event. You're not going to catch Christopher Hitchens at an interfaith dialogue event, although you'll quite often catch somebody who's waving one of their books. And so I'm still struggling with, and Gary and Val would have had much more experience of this, of how to sort of widen it out to draw in people who are interested in religious identity and who are interested in some of the issues that are being thrown up in religious discourse, but who aren't religious and have no desire to be religious. And so this is still, my thoughts are still in process on this, and as you can probably tell. And to the extent that people attending interfaith dialogue events, you know, they do share a core of goodwill. And that core of shared goodwill overcomes any theological differences that they might have. And to an extent, it leads them to place aside theological differences as just too complicated and too intractable. Leave it for another day. And this is why there's such emphasis, I think, on Abrahamic dialogue as well, because on the one hand there's a lot of conflict between the Abrahamic faiths, on the other hand there's a shared common theological background on which we can draw, and we can all happily shake hands at the end and say, oh, we're all children of Abraham after all, even if we're kind of, as Gary said yesterday, a certain amount of road rage happening between us. As far as Muslims are concerned, I think too there's a bit of discomfort in positioning themselves not as a religious lobby group, even though a lot of the shit that's being flung in our direction, for want of a better metaphor, is really not about theology as such. I took part in a series of workshops last year bringing together Muslim and Indigenous women because, on the basis of sharing similar problems to some extent, the problem of addressing gender issues within communities when you're also having to deal with external hostility and when you're also being positioned as objects of rescue from outside. And I know that in approaching Muslims about this initiative, there was a certain amount of resistance because it was seen as making us seem like a racial group rather than a religious group, and somehow by moving towards making ourselves a religious lobby group that would normalise us. I mean, in the words of one Muslim spokesman, if you go around meeting up with other marginalized people on the basis of shared, you know, ethnic problems, then we're just going to end up looking like a, quote, bunch of wogs, unquote. We'd look less like a bunch of wogs if we're standing next to Catholics. If we're standing next to Indigenous people, well, we're all going to look like, well, Indigenous people aren't wogs, but, you know, brown-skinned people together. That's not what we want. We want to look like, we want to look like the Catholic Church. We want to look possibly like the Jews, not too much like the Jews because that's too marginal. We want to look normal and mainstream. And interfaith dialogue is seen by some Muslims as a vehicle for doing that. But some of the people with whom we could usefully, I think, be sharing resources and battling alongside are not going to turn up to interfaith dialogue events unless they also happen to have a religious identity, and then they're not going to be there, you know, on the basis of that shared ethnic marginalisation. They're going to be there on the basis of whatever their religious identity happens to be, and we won't get to talk about those other issues that we also share. And I'll wind it up there.
Thank you, Shakir. Our third panellist is Val Webb. Dr. Val Webb's professional career spans microbiology, business, public relations, writing, art and theology. She has worked in a variety of jobs, including running an art gallery, hospital, public relations and several leadership roles in the Uniting Church of Australia. She began her religious studies in the 1980s and has taught at the University of Minnesota and Augsburg College in the United States and at Whitley College, Melbourne. She's written quite a number of books, including In Defence of Doubt, An Invitation to Adventure, Why We're Equal, Introducing Feminist Theology, and a number of others. Her latest book, Like Catching Water in a Net, Human Attempts to Describe the Divine, won the General Religion category of the USA Best Books 2007 Awards. Val, we're delighted that you're amongst the panellists, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Stephen. I must say, going third is a bit like the person who came out of the committee meeting and somebody said, what's going on in there? And the answer was, everything that's been said has been said, but it's not yet been said by everyone. So if I seem to, you know, reinforce some of the things that have already been said. I think I probably am more interested, having done travelled through theological places, I think now I am more interested in thinking about what we share as human beings, how we relate in that way. Perhaps that's just the business of getting older. But one famous theologian once said, to know one religion is to know none. It's like saying that oranges are our favourite fruit when we really haven't tasted anything else. And I think this has been the stance of many of the exclusivist faith traditions over the centuries, whose answer to things like whose truth is true or whose God is it anyway, is usually heresy trials, erecting fences, or just naming everything else as false. The other end of the spectrum, can anyone really grasp the full insights of all religions in one lifetime and thus grade them for merit? And what's the point anyway when religions emerge from different contexts and cultures to answer different needs of the people at a particular time? One of Richard Dawkins' criticisms of religion is that we label children as Jewish, Muslim, or Christian, as if somehow there's a religious preference written into their genetic makeup. They're children, he argues, who happen to have been brought up in different religious heritages. Now, as we all know, if you put a bunch of toddlers in a room together, they are going to relate to each other, not on their family's faith basis, but on whether they like the other child, whether they think they can demolish the other child, or whether they want the cookie or the toy in the other child's hand, which is pretty much like adult behaviour as well. Young children differentiate on religious grounds only if they've been taught this by adults, whether through segregation from those not of their type or through some learned derogatory characteristics fed with their breast milk. The baby boomers among us will remember the Protestant-Catholic divide of our Australian childhood. Before we even knew what the titles meant, the picture of the other was painted for us. I remember believing as a young child that red hair, rough skin, and the habit of stealing bricks at night from building sites, which one of my Catholic neighbours supposedly did, were universal Catholic characteristics. It wasn't until many years later that I compared notes with my Catholic friends and found they had equally grotesque stereotypes of Protestants. And at that stage, most of us hadn't even encountered anybody from a religion other than the Jewish or Christian heritage. But we heard about in Sunday school, about missionaries going out to those dark places to bring light to pagan children. And so I think Robert Fulcrum's title, All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, is probably true about religious intolerance as well. I'd like to suggest that interfaith dialogue was actually forced on Australians. Indigenous Australians were made to come to terms with an imposed Christianity with little or no opportunity for dialogue unless the invader happened to be interested anthropologically in their culture. Non-Indigenous Australians mostly came from Christian stock, so these beliefs became supreme, or at least certain brands of these beliefs became supreme. And not until later centuries did Australia really have to confront the other in terms of religions other than those. And I think the Christian reaction for dialogue has been quite mixed. I think those who deny that there's truth or salvation in any other religion because Jesus is the way, the truth, the life, see any dialogue as a path simply to conversion of the other. Those who think there is truth but not salvation in other religions see dialogue as a way to bring the other to some full realization. Those who see it simply as an ethnic part of an ethnic package sees dialogue really just as a curiosity, while those who see the dialogue or as many paths to the divine see this dialogue as enhancing both partners in the conversation with fresh insights into the God search. And of course, many Australians simply don't care about religion anyway, and so would see dialogue simply as an academic exercise or else a complete waste of time or somewhere in the middle. I believe that the general idea of religion as many paths to the divine is moving now from the margins of thinking towards the centre for a lot of people, although that's fiercely attacked by some of the conservative religious leaders. And I think this has given us a freedom, particularly people within religious traditions, to find out what other people think, whether they're our school teachers, our doctors, workmates, or friends. Interfaith and intrafaith dialogues also become more important because of religion's overt or hidden role in our politics. Whether we like it or not, there are considerable lobby groups that work with religious ideas, whether it's about stem cell research, funding for religious-based social services, or legislation for same-sex couples. And while today's global aggression is often about ethnicity, economics, and ingrained hatreds than about religion, its roots are still in religious ideologies, and aggression is often played out using selective mandates snipped from various sacred texts. Just as our political leaders now are trying to understand other nations because they want them as allies, as suppliers, or even places of refuge, I think ordinary people are also seeing this, trying to bridge this divide because we need friends, sympathetic workmates, and helpful professionals. People who previously didn't need each other suddenly do. I actually find it difficult to separate interfaith and intrafaith dialogue. I personally have more in common sometimes with people in another religion altogether than those within this in the Christian circle, which will claim the whole absolute truth. Interfaith dialogue, on the other hand, allows me to come to the conversation as a person I am at this moment in my faith tradition and meet another person who is at peace with who they are in theirs. Since neither of us are out to convert the other, we can hopefully therefore converse with respect and each find fresh ways to be better whatever we were before. Good dialogue means listening, not just for openings to correct or manipulate, but a general hunger to learn from an equal. When we do talk, hopefully it's not to judge or manipulate, but to invite further revelations. And, for example, my first question to a Buddhist is not going to be, "You don't believe in God, do you?" But rather, "How do you live out your convictions day by day?" I'll never forget sitting on a mountain in the middle of India with a Hindu friend, and I just said to him, with such a perfect setting, "Just talk to me about God while I listen." And he talked from his own experiences as a human being rather than his Hindu doctrines, and I could say yes to pretty much everything he said, even though our views were couched in different languages and conceptual forms, because our struggle as human beings are similar. And we can learn techniques for survival and flourishing from other human beings. In a different experience, I went to a Buddhist information centre in a temple in Khon Kaen in Thailand. An American Buddhist who was not in robes asked me if he could help and immediately said to me, "Do you know much about Buddhism?" Now, that's a total dialogue stopper. It's a yes-no question without a yes-no answer. You know, in comparison to other lay people, perhaps I do know more about Buddhism. But in contrast to somebody who's lived and studied and been in that tradition the whole of their life, I don't know much about Buddhism. When I said to him, for want of anything better to say, that I taught world religions, he immediately fired off his standard question for those who tick the "know a bit" box. He said, "So why do people say Buddhism isn't a religion?" I answered that some people define religion as having a divine being or divine of some sort, but that wasn't the response that he was geared to pursue. Simply ignoring my answer, he answered himself and said, because it's not faith-based. And then he went on with his usual spiel about it being a way of life, and then asking me questions so that he could move on always to the next phrase in his particular dissertation. His big interest was meditation, its benefits and how to do it. So when he said to me, do you meditate? I immediately remembered I had to meet somebody outside who was waiting for me, because I knew that whatever I said would not be the correct answer. Dialogue didn't happen, even though I had hoped there might be a possibility. Wonderful dialogue is happening today, as the others have mentioned, around kitchen tables, cups of tea, play groups where mums and dads watch their children, and office workers during their lunch breaks, as we share our own human experiences, frustration, dreams. Inevitably, they will include our religious idea and how they help or hinder us. At one stage in my training, I read all the books on how to do interreligious dialogue, interfaith dialogue, and what common ground we had to find so that we did not privilege one tradition against the other by giving value to one particular theme that wasn't valued in the same way as the other. And this is all very well. Yet the basic issue, I think, boils down to, with whom will we dialogue? How many of my friends and acquaintances are from faith traditions other than my own? If the natural course of our life doesn't move us into multi-religious situations, we have to reset our GPSs. Formal opportunities, as we mentioned, are also important so we better understand the motivation and goals of others, and they help us confront the stereotypes of difference. I recently went to a Together for Humanity Foundation, which many of you may be familiar with, government-run organisation in our local high school in Mudgee. And three very fun people, a Muslim, a Christian, and a Jewish woman, came and presented just the most marvellous program with games and role-playing to the high school students, showing them what it feels like to be a minority and bringing out all the traditional stereotypes. And at the end, they asked any of the students to ask any question they liked of these three about their religions. And, I mean, what an opportunity for students in a safe place to be able to ask anything without fear of some sort of reprisal. Which brings us to truth claims. We all know how difficult it is to make universal truth claims anymore, even about the ethics we try to come up with. Thou shalt not kill for a Jain means not even the gnat that comes into your nose. For some Christians, thou shalt not kill means don't kill the fetus, but send some criminal for capital punishment. Thou shalt not kill was certainly not a universal Hebrew thing. There is killing, plenty of killing in the Bible, with the divine warrior leading the army. Interestingly, Jesus chose instead, when asked about the commandments, that wise sage said, love God and love your neighbour. And I think this idea is much more important, how we live than what we believe today. And I think it's common to many of the great founders of world religions. And perhaps I'll just finish with Karen Armstrong, religion scholar. If conventional beliefs make you compassionate, kind, and respectful of the sacred rights of others, this is good religion. If your beliefs make you intolerant, unkind, and belligerent, this is bad religion, no matter how orthodox. Thank you.
Thank you, Val. We have plenty of time for conversations. And perhaps I could just ask you, the three of you, a question. We may have a conversation about this, and it'll be a kickstart to others. The question of sacred texts. Most faith traditions have special texts that they prize, they value. And I'm wondering if the three of you might say something about the importance of sacred text in interfaith dialogue, how they're used and how significant they are.
I enjoy the way sacred texts act and the relationship to them tell me a lot about the way that person's faith is working. And that's true of both intra-faith and interfaith dialogue. I've got some Anglican colleagues, I wouldn't call them friends because we don't share enough, who are very much busy interpreting the Quran. in very negative ways and engaging in terrible negative othering. But I realized that the way they would deal with the scripture that we do share is very different to the way that I would deal with it. Now, in interaction, those differences come out. And it's important to see how it is that different interpretations go on and how it is that the interpretive frame is large within each tradition. Whether that person is willing to move to a larger frame within their own or not is beside the point. But one of the interesting things that that leads into, if you start to engage with somebody about your own scripture and theirs, is one of the wonderful outcomes of genuine interfaith relations. You become more articulate about your own. And that is one of the most foundational things, that, especially Australians who never had to be articulate about faith, because absolutely we're all the same aside from those Catholics, and they were articulate over by themselves, perhaps. But interfaith dialogue actually forces you to answer a question about your faith. And in doing that, you find it, and it becomes more expressive. So the whole role of doing that around text is one of the ways that this new articulate about your faith, and more confident in it, and with a greater confidence, there's more energy to give space for others. And that's one of the fun bits.
Thanks, Gary. Val or Shakira, do you want to respond?
Well, I'm sort of going to talk about in the same tradition. But you know, coming back to the experience of human beings, I think we're all, you know, we're all pretty ignorant of our sacred texts. I mean, I think most of us probably have in our everyday life is an interpretation of our sacred text according to whatever denomination, whatever grouping we're in. And certainly we're usually totally ignorant of the sacred text of any other tradition. You know, I think people get really an amazing surprise to find that the Quran does have stories of Jesus, stories of Mary, and the whole idea of the whole Islamic idea that the Islamic position is the final story of the story of God. That actually incorporates the Jewish story, incorporates the Christian story, and as a final sort of revelation. We're so used to, in our Christian tradition, of seeing the other as wrong, as false, as the enemy. And it's just, I think, stunning to people when they realise that we do share in the Abrahamic tradition, we do share a common story. And I think that's really an interesting place to start. I think Mary has much better press in the Quran than she does in Protestantism. And you know, when you start thinking like that, you have to ask questions. It makes you curious. So what does that sacred text say? And also, I think the whole issue of how we interpret our texts and trying to see the difference in different traditions about how they value their text. And you know, is it metaphorical? Is it literal? Is it, you know, how did it come out of their context? And how does their context come through in that for human beings? Always the question, what is our situation today as human beings, and how can we think theologically, whatever our tradition, from that context?
Thank you, Val. Shakira?
Yeah, I think you can take a step back also and see that people's different relationships to what the text itself is about. And in talking with Christians and Muslims, in some ways I think the Quran occupies a position for Muslims that the crucifixion does for Christians. And that's something that sometimes causes some sticky points. I mean, like, I think for most Christians, the purpose of Jesus' life was the crucifixion and the resurrection. You know, that was what he was sent for. Whereas for Muslims, the purpose that Muhammad, peace be upon him, was sent for was to convey this text, to convey this message. You don't handle the Quran without washing like you do for prayer. You don't, in most Muslim households, let it touch the floor. You don't let anything on which you've written it go into the garbage. In some ways, perhaps that gets treated... Well, like a Sikh household can't have a copy of the Guru Granth Sahib, unless they've got the resources to store it in a particular way. You really need a separate room, in my understanding, and so many Sikh households don't actually own it, and that goes against people's expectations too. And that's something that can come out in interfaith dialogue, because people assume you might carry one in your pocket or something equivalent, your holy text. Well, no, not when it's given that quite physical reverence. And so I remember one interfaith conversation between Muslims and Christians, where one of the Muslim women tried to persuade the Christians that if they could just modify their thoughts about the crucifixion, then we'd be on the same page. And trying to say, well, Christians can't do that, because really that's what Jesus was here for. And really, you know, if you could just accept that Jesus was a prophet instead of, you know, the Messiah, well, you know, absolutely we'd be on the same page. But for Christians, that's not what Jesus was sent for. He wasn't sent to as a prophet. He wasn't sent to deliver a text. He was sent in order to die for our sins and be resurrected. And that's a really central point. So I think even before you sit down and look at the texts, the question of people's relationships to those texts and what they're for and why they're here and why they're part of our lives, that's already sort of something where people learn.
I'd like to just pick that point up. That's so true, that there is a difference of understanding in terms of the texts. But I think it's interesting now. I think that maybe gives us another point of dialogue, because I think in contemporary Christian scholarship and thinking, we are rethinking the significance of Jesus, and you know, whether we can have a different attitude to what was the purpose of Jesus. I mean, asking questions about the fact that our church creeds mention only in passing that Jesus was born and died, and then goes on to some theological discussion. There is absolutely no thing in our church creed, Orthodox creeds, about the life and teachings of Jesus. And so I think contemporary scholarship is perhaps looking more at who Jesus was as a whole, as a human being, as a whole person here on earth. And I think that does open up a lot more discussion if we do start looking at the aspect of Jesus as a prophet within his tradition, knowing that Muhammad did investigate Christianity and Judaism in his own life, and felt that Judaism was too exclusively ethnic, and that Christianity had got sidetracked in their understandings of Jesus. So I think this is a wonderful opportunity to maybe open up that dialogue, and for Christians to learn just how much of the story of Jesus is also in the Quran.
I'm very happy for some questions from the floor. So if you have one, I suggest that you go down to the microphone, make your way down there so everybody can hear your question. And you might be able to find a seat down there while others are asking there, so I encourage you to do that.
Hi, my name is Vittal Shattigar. I am from India originally. So there will be sort of question bias towards my culture. I would like to make one observation, and then I would like to ask a question to the panel, please. The observation is that I have attended, I'm not a social scientist or I'm not from religion background, I'm a scientist. I have attended, out of curiosity, panels like this. My observation has been, particularly in the West, is that the panel does not represent the religions of, say, the Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, for example, including today's panel. And that population is well over 2 billion, right? So I feel that if the true dialogue has to take place and understanding has to take place, we may have to make very conscious effort to include representation. I understand we can't represent every religion. It will be too many numbers. Okay, moving on to the question. As a person of Hindu background, but I'm not religious, certainly I value my culture, and religion is part of my culture. One point that irritates me all the time, I'm sure that's the case with many fellow Indians, is the commercial world taking liberty of some of the symbols that our culture values and use it inappropriately, right? And that leads, I feel that's not a religious conflict as a matter of fact. It is affecting, or it affects, I feel that my culture is not valued, I am not respected, when the society knows that it is a sacred symbol, even though I am not religious. So I would like to ask the question to the panel, you know, how to respond to situations of this kind, because I wonder about it. Should I get angry, move around, or how to deal with that in a society that is not Hindu-oriented?
Thank you. Shakira.
Yeah, I do think that it's a pity that the emphasis on Abrahamic faith has meant that people from non-Abrahamic religions haven't been as included as possible. And that also brings me back to the issue of, like, religion versus ethnicity. For Muslim women of South Asian background, they share a lot of issues in common with Hindu and Sikh women, because Muslims in South Asia have absorbed a lot of cultural practices in all the hundreds of years they've been there. So, and there's an inclination to just dismiss that as not being Islamic, so somehow we don't need to look at that. You know, it would be useful for Hindu and Sikh and South Asian Muslim women to be talking together about issues like dowry, issues like marriage practices, which are common to all of them. And there are also common issues to do with marriage and divorce that are shared with Jewish women. There has been a certain limited amount of conversation between Jewish and Muslim women on that basis. As so far as I'm aware, not between Hindu women and South Asian Muslim women. And that would be useful, I think. And also between, like, we concentrate so much on Palestine and Israel when it comes to talking about interreligious conflict, and on if only Jews and Christians and Muslims would get on better, then that whole Middle East situation, you know, solved, which for a start, probably not. And for another thing, you know, there's a conflict happening in South Asia too at a low level, which isn't going to really be solved by Muslims and Hindus sitting down together, but it couldn't be heard either by more dialogue in that area.
You've put your finger on, I think, a very major point of Australian culture and society. The disrespect gradient is changing. Reference was made to the relations between Protestants and Catholics until really into the 1950s and 60s, where only English Protestantism was valued and held up as normal, and everything else was somehow degraded, unnormal, dangerous, silly, stupid, magical, and all the other things that were said about the other. What's happened of late is at least Catholics have been normalized and have come into the range of the acceptable, and the question is becoming, who else? And that whole movement, we've become religiously diverse, but the genuine movement of respect and inclusion, which means also respect for the symbols and expecting to see those symbols respectfully present within our visible landscape, etc., is something that we are beginning to learn as various religious groups build their places of worship in styles that suit them, whether it's mosques or temples or other things. In most Australian cities, there are now excellent examples of those things becoming present. Over time, I would expect such symbols to come into general use within Australia. General use is a problem in Australia. When Australians respect something, they're just as likely to respect it as send it up. And that's part of the way we are, and how it is that groups who take offense at that deal with that, and we with them, is a serious ongoing problem requiring precisely the kind of discussion and interfaith dialogue that you request. That is, that all groups are involved, all groups participate, and that there is a discussion, including those who have no faith. I'm on the Premier's multi-faith advisory group in Victoria, and it's very interesting. We've been meeting now for 2 years and have started to get to grips with issues that put things at a slightly edgier than just being nice to each other level. And one of the big issues is, do we let the secularists in? Do they come in as a religion or as a faith community or whatever else? That's very interesting, because with the diversity, that is one of the viewpoints in the public sphere, standing alongside of other ones, should they be included. But the kind of dialogue you call for is what we need to have.
Oh, I just agree with the question. I think it's a very valid question, and I've sat through a lot of in the American Academy meetings of Native American people, just protesting at how Americans have borrowed the symbols, the dream catcher, that anyone can buy their dream catcher and hang it up, and people being so rightly angry about this that they refuse to come to the meetings and refuse to talk about it anymore, because it's just like, it's almost a voyeurism on the part of the dominant religions to find out what's going on in their religion and what can we borrow. And I think it's a big issue, and I agree with his comments.
Thank you. Another question.
Thank you very much for all that you've said today. My question sort of relates to the first part of the previous person's question. Just to put it in context, I'm a bit of a convert from interfaith dialogue. I started off being involved with it, not having religious conviction, and now I'm in the process of becoming a Sister of Mercy in the Catholic Church. So it's converted me to ask those questions about myself and come to my own religious convictions. But I was wondering about, in the process of bringing together groups for dialogue, and I'm not talking about the kitchen table dialogue, because that is certainly about including everyone, but when you come to including in a formal way groups around the table, how do you define boundaries for inclusion and not including other groups? Especially when you could have, say, a group of flying spaghetti monster devotees who've got all the structures that we have, but yet maybe not the same historical background, or when you've got another group which has a similar characteristics to a religion, but maybe not the structures that we have, or looks to us from a very structured kind of religion to be a blend. How do you involve them? Thank you.
Well, pardon.
The various major interreligious groups do this differently. I'm part of both Religions for Peace and the Parliament of the World's Religions. Religions for Peace tends to work with the nine big global world religions, and the rest can come along if they want, but doesn't take that on. The Parliament of the World's Religions, meeting, by the way, in Melbourne in December of this year, I highly, highly recommend you to come, invites everyone and doesn't put boundaries up. If you consider yourself to have a religion or none, you're welcome. Your voice will be heard, and people come as individuals, not representatives of any religion, any nation, or anything else but themselves. And in that way, we don't worry. We have everything from Anglicans to Zoroastrians, from Scientologists to a large number of pagans, and it's all in, because each of these groups have voices grounded in their own spirituality, or none, and we're making it very clear that those without are welcome to come in and speak into these issues that we're facing in that way. In terms of how it works in terms of national boundaries and national groups, it is exceedingly difficult to include absolutely everyone. But if you're having a consultation, as I've recently run on freedom of religion and belief in Australia, we made sure that every group was invited and was able to speak. So if you're going to listen to religion and religious voices, you have to listen to an exceedingly wide variety of extremely different groups, and I just love it. It's wonderful. But if you're trying to have a representative panel, then paying attention to what's in your community and who's putting themselves forth becomes the issue. But it isn't easy. But all I can say is being open and not trying to make a definition, because once you say you're in or you're out, you've decided what is or isn't a religion. Do you have to be organized like the Catholics to get in, or would it be okay to be organized like the Baptists? I mean, those things begin to be exclusive, and all those definitions fall over. Be inclusive. It's fun.
I just like to, I think one way that this has worked in different settings is by gathering around an issue or a theme. You know, I think sometimes we get hung up sometimes on people's doctrines and people's labels and, you know, whether they're not in or out. But, you know, the theme of justice. Is justice an issue we all care about? Yeah. Is the issue of women an issue we all care about? And I think that's where some very successful dialogues happened, where women get together and talk about their issues and then will bring in their experiences to that, and certainly issues of justice and other things. So perhaps that is another way for us.
I think that some of the emphasis on the Abrahamic dialogue might be because, by definition, it does keep out the, what did you call it, flying circle, sorts of spinny wheelie things, groups.
Don't count on it.
I have, in sort of informal conversation, heard people say if we make it Abrahamic, then the flying saucers, circle, wheelie things lot won't turn up. And I think it is a logistical thing when talking, again, sort of informal conversations with organisers of interfaith events, that on the one hand, they don't want to be exclusive, they want to be inclusive. On the other hand, there's only so many chairs at the platform, and it makes for a very long event if you have to sit through everybody's prayers. And, you know, and it can mean that you get sidetracked by groups who, where they're, you know, they're not fundamentally, you know, there aren't all that many people represented by that religious label, whatever it might be, and it's time-consuming to be inclusive, but I agree with Gary, it's better to be inclusive than not. It's difficult, but it's better.
Another question.
Can you just say very briefly,
it is indeed...
Just a minute. Nobody can hear you. No, you'd have to go to the microphone to make your comment. Wait. Yes, the microphone.
It is indeed very encouraging to hear your words, that there are people concerned about a very important issue that we are facing virtually daily. It would be very comforting also if we only could believe that religion would stand on its own. But as I see it, religion has always been, in the course of history, used as a political football for their own ends. Now, I can see what we do by this interfaith dialogue is bailing out the boat that has got a hole or many holes. And of course, we don't want to sink, we bail. But isn't it important also to, at one stage, look at the holes, the political holes in the boat? And I can see one very big hole in the Middle East. Is the panel empowered, or have got the panel any influence in the political sphere to reach across that way as well? That is my question.
Yes, religion and politics is always an issue. Every religion has a view of the ideal, has an ethical domain, and feels incumbent and feels called or required to seek to rework the world according to their views. And we have both good and bad examples of that happening. Good examples, the building of hospitals, the rolling out of social justice, a whole variety of ways where religiously motivated people have made this a profoundly better world than it was before they were here. We also have examples where that political domination has become ugly. I mentioned the case of Sri Lanka before, where all of a sudden a nation that had been diverse had been getting along with some fractious inter-religious relations, but not as bad. Suddenly, some people said, we better make this a Buddhist state. It's those pressures to make things monocultural that usually result in the worst things being done, where people get trod on. Or attempts to build the New Jerusalem. I'm always a little bit allergic when somebody wants to build the New Jerusalem. It usually means somebody's going to get run roughshod over. We need to be aware of these things, but these things are balanced. That is, religion is, in its association with the political force, ambiguous. There are times when it's used in ways that provide the energy to overcome profound evil. I could only mention civil rights in the United States of America, which would not have happened without profound religious involvement right from day one through to its inclusion in law. There's also negative occasions, and we don't need to belabor them, but we need to be careful about them and attentive to them. Also in this discussion, have to be very careful that just because there might be a problem in place A, to assume that that problem will be occurring in some other place is a terrible mistake to make. And some Australians, seeing problems elsewhere, begin to worry about problems here without attending to the very nature of the kind of relationships that are going on in our society, which are very different to those in other societies, in precisely the kinds of ways that diminish the capacity of religious groups to have much of a hand on a political lever worth pulling, although some yank pretty hard.
Al or Shakira, do you either of you wish to respond?
I think that's
another question.
I was enormously encouraged by your description of the decency and the humanity of the grassroots discussion on religion. But from my observations kicking around the ecumenical scene for some time, you hit a brick wall when you get to leadership level, because the leaders of faiths are the ones who are charged with defining the faith, and they have the most to lose from any mixture of turf or any blurring of the boundaries. So when does the grassroots movement become taken seriously by the leadership, or is it something that they just get overwhelmed with?
Oh, I think that's a huge question. And I think a very good question. I think that is a struggle that we, you know, in all our faith traditions, whatever they are, we have authorities as part of a definition really of a religion. And so in some way the tradition has to be authoritative. Certainly its history or its source goals have to in some way be authoritative. So the struggle becomes then, in what way is the past, are our doctrines authoritative, and in what way are they evolving? And I think they've always been evolving, but somehow we get the impression within institutions sometimes that they haven't been. And therefore we have to protect certain things rather than allow the context to suggest maybe new and fresh ways in which to go. And as the speaker pointed out, I think it is at the level of authorities who really have the authority to protect the tradition as well as hopefully allow a tradition to move along. I think the grassroots is great because I think that's eventually, it's like those 99 monkeys and finally the 100th monkey just is enough to make the difference. But it's a process.
I think leaders are very important as role models to show respectful relationships, and where they do not do that, it erodes. We had that under John Howard. And we saw how we can erode multicultural respect very quickly by the toss-off comment here, there, and the other place. And so the grassroots needs to call on and support religious leaders who are engaging in interfaith dialogue or at least showing respect. Because as we know, within each of our traditions, there are those who say you should not do that. The second side is as we have more interreligious dialogue and as we have more rubbing up against each other, the issue of boundaries is going to become more important. And the whole drawing of boundaries and boundary maintenance has become more important. As groups say, well, if you're going to be one of us, then there's the boundary. As opposed, I would say, to paying attention to the central tendency, which is far more important, but to me. But that boundary, those boundaries are becoming tighter. Certainly Catholics have drawn their boundaries more tight. I used to be welcome at Catholic Mass. I'm not anymore, I'm told, to my face. And that's part of saying, well, if you're this, then there's the container, you come in with that. Now, Robert Frost said, good fences make good neighbors, and there's a sense that it's in perhaps the blurring of boundaries that some of the leaders might get fearful, but I don't, they better wake up, because the boundaries amongst the religious containers in Australia are pretty porous at the moment, and I don't see efforts to draw them tightly as going to tighten them up that much. But it's a very interesting issue to watch at the moment as leaders actually tighten the boundaries at precisely the time when a lot of people are moving around and saying, be respectful. But respect doesn't necessarily erode a boundary.
Yes, this comes back to a theme that's been touched upon with regard to Muslim communities more generally, which is what leaders? Because leaders represent a segment of Muslim communities, not the whole. We don't have one leader, although it's been perceived that we do. And our former mufti was often described as our spiritual leader, and there were lots of Muslims, and I was one of them, yelping and jumping up and down saying, not my leader. And so it's a bit confusing, I think, sometimes with people organizing interfaith events to sort of know exactly which bit to reach out to, who they should be talking to, you know, and if you want the Muslims along, then kind of you have to send like 20 different invitations, or there's some Muslims that are going to feel left out. And I'll often be in conversation with a non-Muslim who will say that they went to a fabulous Muslim-hosted interfaith event and they thought they might see me there, and you kind of have to say, oh yeah, that was more a Turkish event. Or that was, you know, oh, those were the Lebanese, you know. And, you know, they're much more welcoming to Jews and Catholics and people from flying saucer spinny things than they are to other Muslims who are of the wrong ethnicity. They're not exactly tell you to go away, but you're not likely to be on their email list, and you sort of feel a bit of a gatecrasher if you turn up, and you're certainly not going to be invited to speak at some of those events. So these sort of Muslim inter-ethnic conflicts do tend to come out in the interfaith dialogue scene as well, and it's awkward, it's tricky. And certainly as far as what leaders, well, it's the same thing. You're not going to find leaders who represent more than a segment.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on something that Val said about, if I'm paraphrasing it right, at the end of the day, the question is who our acquaintances and friends are, the people that we gather together. And I think I'm suffering from interfaith dialogue burnout after 20 years where I have, you know, had many, many wonderful evenings and days and weekends gathering and learning from each other. And at the end of that day, I have no enduring friendships that have emerged from those connections that I've made from people. And I'm wondering if the three of you might share any insights that you have about how to kind of take that step from kind of emerging briefly from the safety of our own religious communities to talk to others to actually forging enduring friendships with each other?
Well, that's a good question. But, you know, I think it comes down to, you know, in my experience, and I speak from my experience, and I appreciate your experience in that. I think it comes down to being available to have friends who think differently from ourselves. All friendships don't work. And at some point in a friendship or an acquaintance, you know, you just really don't have things in common. But, you know, I remember somebody once saying, he was an insurance salesman, he said, you don't get down about the 9 people who don't accept your policy, because number 10 will. Now, and I think that perhaps is in friendship as well. I really think we become friends on a lot of common interests first. And it's that, I think that, may I say that that is perhaps the goal rather than the dialogue. The goal is to make, is to become friends across these borders. And then once we are friends, then that friendship will hopefully include the dialogue. It may not be a formal dialogue. It might be something very informal. It may never ever come to some great mind-shattering revelation where we solve something. But it might help us to share with each other when our child dies, or share with each other when our spouse dies. Or it might be just to be able to say to another person, you know, I'm afraid about this. And somebody else might have a new image for us. Now, my last book's on imaging God and going across religions of how we image the divine. And sometimes we just need some fresh images. And maybe that's what we get in this, not the full-blown dialogue, but perhaps just one new image that can help us flourish or survive or carry us on or keep us talking to another person without having to erect that boundary. I remember a woman in her probably 80s once at a workshop I did on doubt said to me later, she said, my children grew up in the church. I took them every Sunday. They were involved in everything. When they became adults, they both were moved into a Hindu tradition. She said, I didn't know what to do. Had I, you know, she went through all of the own self, guilt she felt that she should have. But she said, what I decided to do, the thing they always did was when they meditated, they walked and chanted every day. So she said, I just made up my own chant. And she said, I walked with them. So every day she would walk and she would say her chant or her words in her faith tradition while her sons were saying theirs. And, you know, she said it became the best thing. We became closer through this because we used to joke about whose God was going to hear first. So I think maybe it's about the friendship.
Could I say I'm a total state school fundamentalist for this reason? And I realize there are faith schools who are actively reaching out to people of different religions and who are actively involved in interfaith dialogue too. But I do think that as we get older, we do tend to just, we self-select our friends and the people we are hanging out with. And they tend to be people who are like us. When you're at school, you don't have much choice except to mix with the mob that you've chucked in with. When I was growing up and at a state school in, you know, Bible Belt Queensland, not enormously religiously diverse in lots of ways, but I formed friendships then with evangelical Christian girls that sort of lasted well into adulthood. And we did find what we had in common, you know. Once I was an adult, I avoided Christians of that type, not Christians in general, but Christians who were like, you know, fundamentalist, if you want to put it in really sort of reductive terms, because they were just people with whom I felt I could have nothing in common. While I was at school, I believed, you know, we did have things in common and we found them. Once my daughter was at school, I found myself again in contact with those kind of Christians just in the car park, just after school. And sometimes that was a bit fractious or more than a bit fractious. But I did become very good friends with one of those other mothers. She was extraordinarily generous to me when I got sick. She took me out to dinner while a group of young people from her church cleaned my entire house. I would have thought that I would be as happy about that as, you know, if the Al-Qaeda Brigade for the Disciplining of Naughty Muslim Girls volunteered to clean my house, but Jenny lined it up, and I was more than grateful to accept that gesture from her, and we would not have come into contact in any other context but the school. And I think that the growth of private education, which really is religiously based education in a lot of cases, has meant that we have a more fractured society. So with the greatest respect to friends of all religions who I know are deeply involved in the faith-based education side of things, and I know that some of those schools are, you know, wonderful, nurturing places which are not religiously exclusive by any means, but yes, here I am. I'm a fundamentalist on a few things, and state education is one of them.
Another question.
I'm motivated to ask a question by Gary's comment that religion in politics is always an issue. And notwithstanding our supposed reliance on the Westminster system, in South Australia, an unelected, thank you, religious professional in the person of Monsignor Capo has been given access to the inner cabinet and, for all practical purposes, has ministerial status. I'm wondering what the panel thinks of this, and have you any ideas as to how that particular development is likely to play out? Thank you.
I'm sorry, could you clarify the role this person has and how he got there?
Well, my understanding is that he has ministerial status and he is involved in policy discussions and has a role in policy formation.
And is he an elected member of the House?
He is not in any sense elected.
Right. Do you have any idea what skills, other than his Monsignor status, he is bringing to this role that might be of some value to the state?
I am quite confident that he is a very skilled person and has quite a lot to contribute, but the fact is we are supposed to be operating under the Westminster system, and it seems to me that in the community at large you would find people with all kinds of specialised skills that would have a lot to contribute.
Okay,
so why one and not the other?
Okay, I agree. The problem is, you say the Westminster system. In the Westminster system, we would have bishops in the House of, in the Senate. And so we don't really have the full Westminster system. You're objecting to the fact that this person is religious and having a ministerial role.
Oh, no, I'm not objecting. I'm merely asking what the panel thinks of
okay,
this
well,
development.
I mean, some people would object to that, and indeed, it's interesting. At some point, the Pope said, "Thou shalt not, as priests, run for office." And that took a bunch of people out of politics in the United States of America who were otherwise some pretty leading figures elected to office, etc. And so there's concern on both sides about the interface between a person of religion, or in this case, official religious position, and official political position. This came up, of course, in the case of Archbishop Hollingworth becoming Governor General, and there were objections that a person of religion couldn't, of religious status, couldn't do that. There's an ordained person shouldn't know to do those sorts of things. I think it points to some of the problematic areas, or at least where we attend to these issues. We certainly have the case of Stephen Fielding, who is a person of religion, who was elected to office, and when I try to explain how he got there to my American friends, the only explanation that makes any sense is just to say it was a miracle. And he has been in that role using his religious background as a way to couch, express, and somehow shape his positions on various issues, even though they line up with others. Now, again, how this person with ministerial status in the cabinet, yes, has a great deal of opportunity to shape policy, etc., I'm not sure how it is that would necessarily be inimical to the people, although there might be some places where such a person would have to declare a conflict of interest. And how they do that in the cabinet, I don't know. But I certainly know that on boards of directors and companies, if you had that kind of corporate conflict of interest, you'd have to declare a conflict of interest. On the other hand, if you have certain skills to bring to the board, those are valuable. And it's sorting those things out that's interesting in this case. And I appreciate your standing there while I dialogued, or at least threw back some questions to try to open up the case that you brought. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your answer. It is a difficult question.
Yeah, it is. And
thank you. Another question.
G'day. I heard you discussing how at some forums, like I think, for instance, the Parliament of World Religions, if I've got that title correct, welcome people of all faiths and of none. And I'm very curious to hear about what do those people of no faith come there to talk about? What are their interests and questions? And what's your experience of them being there? Thank you.
Well, the person of no faith does not come with no ethical background or value position. And certainly on issues of indigenous reconciliation or social justice or the ecology or other things may come in with particular skilled backgrounds, but often come in with a less fully articulate value base than, say, a Christian or a Jew or a Buddhist in the same context, and begin to discover their own value base in the conversation, even as the others become more articulate about theirs. What we don't allow to happen is for any one group to put down another. So we wouldn't have discussions about flying saucer willy gig things, because that's a put down of new religious movements, and we wouldn't use that kind of terminology in the Parliament, and if someone did, they'd be politely asked not to. And so if that secular person or person of no belief were beginning to say that those of us who have belief are somehow silly or have had our brains removed, we'd suggest that perhaps they listened a little bit longer about how our faith relates to, say, issues of ecology, issues of social justice, issues of reconciliation, and come along and continue to listen to us. In that, again, the richness becomes greater so long as everybody is giving from the fullness of themselves. And that's the challenge, and that's what we try to get happening. And I hope that we'll also have sessions on faith, science, etc., but it'll be around particular issues. Thank you.
I think in the general dialogue, anyway, that people are... I'm not sure people are concretely what they are for all time. And I think often in a dialogue, you have people who might come in and say, I'm an atheist, for the want of a better word, often, because they are distancing themselves from what they would see as traditional Christian belief, traditional Jewish, whatever it is their atheism comes from. And, you know, I think we're all on a journey, and I think there's moments that perhaps we all feel we're atheists, and there are other moments that perhaps we're agnostics, that other lovely in-between word that sort of solved the barrier with having to commit one side or the other. And so I think we are on it. Certainly in my evolution as a person, I think I've been in different places at different times. But it doesn't take me out of the journey. And I think some of the perhaps the best religious seekers would call themselves atheists, because they have no other category in which to put themselves which allows them to stand with authenticity. So I think we are talking about a journey. I think everybody's in the discussion, and sometimes the questions coming from people with no faith are the most gripping and pertinent ones.
We have... Shakira, did you want to say? You don't have...
No, I was just thinking that the term atheist does have different overtones in different places, in different locations. When you use the word seeker, that reminded me, and I was trying to remember where from, but I have read one writer talking about how he started to call himself a seeker when he was travelling in India, because saying you didn't have a religion, let alone saying the word atheist, just it alienated people too much. And that wasn't what he meant. It carried overtones that he didn't intend.
he meant that he didn't have a religious affiliation. He didn't mean that he hated religion or, you know, was anti-God.
Yes.
We have time for one quick question from the floor. Thank you.
Yes, good afternoon, companions. I'm reminded of the late Shirley Strawn, who once sang that ego is not a dirty word. Are we saying today that syncretism is also not a dirty word?
It's interesting to me that we have talk of bricolage as individuals take charge of their spiritual life and have a bit of this and have a bit of that and shop around. There's a great deal of that happening. Syncretism, the charge of syncretism presupposes a pristine, pure, and undefiled version of, let's say, Christianity, to which you might add this bit or that, which was somehow divinely revealed in its full form, as opposed to having taken something from, say, the Romans about holidays or other things. Syncretism has been an activity of human beings from day one as we listen, take things into our experience, re-express our faith in symbols that are more current, relevant, try to find new ways to image God, and in doing that we take things from all over the place. I think those who are worried about syncretism are trying to impose a purity which doesn't exist within their own faith.
I would say ditto. I think actually the history of certainly Christianity is a history of syncretism.
Yep.
The difference now is we're admitting it.
Some of it.
Some of it.
I'd broadly agree, but I'd also say that there's such a thing as appropriation. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of picking and choosing little symbols from faith that really aren't your faith and that you actually don't aspire to belong to, but you think it looks pretty. You know, that can be a put down rather than a tribute, you know.
Just briefly to our three speakers, if you could look into your crystal ball, what kind of Australia could you imagine with the kind of approaches to interfaith dialogue that you have been talking about if that continued for the next 20 or 30 years?
I said something in the talk yesterday. I quoted an Australian who is saying that Australia has a unique, in his opinion, Tony Kelly, has a unique opportunity because it does not have all the baggage of Europe or is moving away from that and finding its own voice. And I added to his comment, and it doesn't have the self-absorption of the United States, which I can say because I've lived there for 30 years. His idea is that Australia has a space and a circumstances where we might be able to describe the world in other terms, in other ways, that we might be able to discover, we maybe have the experience and the situation to find new, fresh language about God, about the whole religious dialogue, whatever we want to say. I think there's a lot of work we can do across traditions in talking about how we experience the divine and how we name the divine and how we engage the divine, these sorts of issues, because I think that is a really good common point that we can perhaps start at. And if the descriptions of God are metaphorical, coming from cultures and contexts, which they have been across religious history, what are the sorts of divine images? How will we talk about the sacred within our Australian space, taking into consideration the land, our Indigenous traditions, our multi-faith traditions that have come here? Is there something we can say about our experience of the sacred that might be different and unique and a voice perhaps that the whole world might hear?
We do have a very special place, and I agree with absolutely everything Val said. I want to add another dimension. This great land has been multi-faith, multicultural, multilingual for about 55,000 years. It doesn't mean we want to appropriate Indigenous spirituality, but it is the context that we live in. It is the historical context that we live in. And as we begin to find that we are freed from our cultural and our past to begin to think and move in free ways, we actually are doing that in our own Australian way. Yeah, shyly, hopefully, tenderly, in the heart, not bombastically like the U.S., but in our own style, searching, moving, talking with each other, and out of that will emerge, no, not a new religion, but a new freshness of diversity, of being comfortably with each other in our spirituality.
Just briefly, Shakira, would you like to make a comment?
I get very nostalgic when I hear people reminisce about experiences of cosmopolitanism, as people used to have and still do have in some locations in India, of just where everybody celebrated each other's religious festivals together, where it wasn't considered an exclusive practice. Like my boss, my Jewish Iranian boss, used to talk about in the old days in Iran, where she saw the lamp from her Zoroastrian neighbor across the way, you know, because lamps and light, the flame, and where she shared meals during Ramadan with her Muslim neighbors. And I would like that kind of cosmopolitanism to be more and more a part of our lives.
Friends, the title, the short title of this panel conversation was Talking in Tongues, but we've had some very accessible tongues. And I'd like to thank on your behalf Shakira, Gary and Val for the conversation they have initiated.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.